Live from the mist-enshrouded mountaintop fortress that is X and Y Communications headquarters, you're listening to the world-famous Mountaintop Podcast. And now, here's your host, Scott McKay.
All right, gentlemen, welcome to yet another episode of the world-famous Mountaintop Podcast. My name is Scott McKay, at Scott McKay on both Clubhouse and Twitter. You can find me on Instagram at Real Scott McKay. The name to search on YouTube is mine, Scott McKay, to find all the YouTube videos and other goodies. The website is mountaintoppodcast.com. And gentlemen, if you are not yet a part of our thriving Facebook group, the Mountaintop Summit on Facebook, well, you should be. Come join us. We have a lot of fun. Today, speaking of fun, oh boy, do we have a barn burner of a topic for you today. As a matter of fact, we were going to talk about just a bit, a subset of what we're actually going to talk about until we got to know each other a little bit prior to clicking record on this particular show and decided we had a much better, more generalist topic that would really, really give us plenty of fodder for a very spirited discussion. So today we're going to talk about, are you a jerk without realizing it? Now, I know most of you guys aren't really jerks. That was kind of a clickbaity title. But the thing is, see, my guests today, and yes, that's plural. I have two ladies on today. This is only the second time in history I've had two guests on at the same time. So it'll be a bit of a juggling act, but I think we can handle it. My guests are Heather Hilliard and Anne Dronitsaris, and they are from Toronto, Canada with Caliber Leadership Systems. They are very, very smart. They know what they're doing. They've been training people to be better leaders, men and women. They say mostly men, by the way. And today we're going to talk about kind of some of the ways we get blindsided, not only by jerks, but by being a jerk. So without anything further, Heather and Anne, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Scott. Great to be here.
Yeah, good to have you ladies on. Now, listen, we talked about so many things and I wrote so many notes before we got started on this show. And I'm incredibly excited to hear what your takes are going to be, what your respective take is going to be, both of you, on this topic du jour. Tell us a little bit about your working relationship and how you two know each other and what got you interested in this particular field.
Well, why don't I start it off? This is Heather, just to differentiate our voices, since there are two of us on the show with you here, Scott. Anne and I actually have a really interesting story behind us. Anne actually gave birth to me when she was just a week shy of her 17th birthday and put me up for adoption. Fast forward 27 years later, she and I managed to connect and reunite, as they call it, with adoption processes. And 3 years later, we started working together. So we've now been in business together for almost 25 years, mostly working with on our combined passion for helping people to achieve their potential through understanding of personality and through developing their capabilities. So that's kind of a snapshot. I'll let Anne kind of add to the story.
Yes, another interesting factor in our journey together is that I've actually adopted Heather because when we realized after Heather having children that I had no legal right to my grandchildren, we decided to go to court and I adopted Heather officially. So she's my biological daughter, she's my adoptive daughter, and she's my business partner, the trifecta. It's an amazing relationship that we have together because we bring a combination of perspectives to the work. Heather coming more from the background in consulting in a large organization at Mercer, and myself coming up through psychotherapy and psychology and neuropsychology, the neuropsychology of development, starting off as a leadership coach, and then bringing it more together with Heather into organizational work where we combine systems and people to get really powerful results in organizations.
All that's long for, you're both really, really smart and dedicated and work great together.
Truly.
But I, Scott, one of the things I'll add to that is that Anne and I have kind of this way of looking at our lives as petri dishes for the work that we do with our clients. So rest assured that the work we do and our approaches with our clients, we use with ourselves, we use with our spouses, our husbands, our children. And so it's actually been a really interesting thing because we have very much integrated our personal lives and our work lives and how we bring all of that together for our clients as well, I think is a little bit different than what you might typically see in that coaching consulting relationship.
So in other words, Anne's been using this on you with great success.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, okay.
Man, that is an amazing story. It's almost reminiscent of me being my own grandpa, you know? The Grandpa Jones song from Hee Haw.
Oh, yeah.
I have to ask about the nature versus nurture thing, or these guys are going to come at me with torches and pitchforks. How much alike were you two after having not been in each other's lives? And how much of it was really you having to get to know each other and realize you're very different also? I mean, that seems like a fantastic example of something people put a lot of research into. How did that work for you?
Yeah, I guess I'll start off with that. I think it was a little bit eerie. You did just some of the similarities, mannerisms, tone of voice, orientation to life and the world on a general perspective. And, you know, I grew up in an adoptive family. I have two siblings that I grew up with. I wasn't like anyone in my family. And then when I connected with Anne and hers, it was like this instant, oh yeah, we're like cut from the same cloth. We're, you know, it's like that notion of we can complete each other's sentences. We just are in sync. It didn't mean that we weren't having to develop and forge a relationship. So there was nurturing that came along with it. But the nature was very, you know, hardcore. There was no question that I was her daughter.
How about that? Isn't that something?
Yes.
You know, there's no chance that the milkman fathered either of my two youngest. Because they have exactly the same bad habits randomly that I do.
Yeah.
I look at them and go, God, that's my kid. Yeah, absolutely. Isn't that something? All right. So let's get down to brass tacks here, as Ross Perot once said here in Texas. We're going to talk about the concept of being a jerk on this show, which we really have never talked about. Probably to my discredit and shame because, man, I've been a jerk for so long withholding this from these guys, right? I say that tongue in cheek, but I know, Anne, you said that you really wanted to define for these guys what a jerk really is. And I think that's an important starting point. So go for it.
And truly, if you think about how easy it is for us to label someone or judge someone's behavior that's unexpected, or we don't like it, or we don't like the way it makes us feel, these terms like jerk or dick or, you know, Richard, as we like to call certain types of behaviors to make it a little bit more congruent with organizations.
The word you're looking for is asshole.
Getting to the actual essence of what are people experiencing? What is the issue that they're actually having or talking about? And if it's coming from employees, for example, is it coming from, for example, an employee who has a sense of entitlement and they're coming at their manager thinking that their manager or their leader should just let them do whatever they want to do? And when they get a no or when they get performance feedback, suddenly their boss is a jerk. And they're only a nice guy when they're allowed to do whatever they want to do. It's like parenting. And so when we look at the definition of jerk, it's sometimes connected with what are commonly called narcissistic bosses as well, where any time a leader drives their own agenda and wants something done the way they want it done, they're called narcissistic. And so it's really easy for people to put labels on it and make leaders into villains and employees into victims. And working with that, we see it all the time. It's so enlivened right now because there's this tendency in our culture right now for everyone to just really get off on being a victim. And I'm a, you know, my group of people, we're all bigger victims than your group of people, and easily turning anyone with a different opinion or a sense of authority as leaders need to have into the bad guys.
Well, those guys are a bunch of jerks. No, I'm kidding. I'm not kidding, actually. Now, you just gave a fascinating rendition of what it means to be jerky and tied it to being narcissistic. And one thing that sort of was, I don't know if it was ironic, but it was certainly meta level in this discussion, was if you, was the part where you said, if you are a nice person until you don't get what you want, and then the other person who just didn't kowtow to all your whims and desires and selfish stuff is the jerk, well, then that's gaslighting. You're the jerk, not them. You need to look in the mirror. Did I catch that correctly?
Yes, in so many words, I'll agree with that. However, both of the people in that scenario would be unconscious, that they're acting in an unconscious way, and both of them are being self-protective by blaming the other person and not really saying, okay, well, I have an issue, or I feel disappointed because I can't do what I want to do, or my ego's been shattered because I got some feedback about my performance and it doesn't align with how I think of myself. And so people aren't really honest with themselves. And so we call people names because we can't be honest with ourselves about our own performance. And that could be a leader, or it can be an employee.
Or it can be somebody you're in a relationship with. It doesn't even have to be in the organizational context. We see this same behavior gets played out in interpersonal relationships, in couples, in family dynamics, and where the individuals are being jerks without realizing it. They don't understand that the impact of their judgment or their behavior or their choice of words, how that is actually putting them into that, you know, quote unquote jerk category, or what we call that self-protective approach to interacting.
I think that's a solid point. And I would add to that, that we bring expectations into relationships, either spoken or unsaid. And when the other person doesn't deliver on our expectations for that relationship, we can often turn on them and think they're being bad people. And the example that comes to mind immediately is when a man and a woman go out on a first date and they're talking about, you know, what are you looking for? Right. And the guy says, well, I never want to get married and I never want to have any children. And a year later, they're still dating, but the woman's like, oh my God, he's such a jerk. He won't marry me. He won't put a ring on my finger. And he still says he doesn't want to have any children. It's like, well, why is he a jerk? He's been honest the whole time. He told you that from day one, but he's the jerk, right? That's the kind of thing
exactly.
We're talking about. Okay. All right.
The other point around this, and this happens in leader-employee relationship as well as personal relationships, is the idea that the other person is a mind reader and I shouldn't have to talk about what I need. The employee will believe that the leader should know what they want, or the leader believes that employees should know what to do without having to tell them, in the same way in a relationship. And I've heard this male to female and female to male, where one of them will say, they should know exactly what I need. They love me. If they loved me, they'd know. And so rather than taking responsibility and empowering themselves and asking for what they need, they act like jerks.
I once worked at a restaurant when I was much younger, and the manager they hired would bark at us in Colombian Spanish and hold us accountable. And when you said to her, all right, ma'am, you told us what to do in Spanish, and we had no idea what you were saying. She would respond as if we were lying to her. Like, no, I didn't. I said it in English. And I'm like, oh, wow, this lady's just got to get herself sorted. But she would hold us accountable for not doing what she said and then get even angrier. Well, she got fired after a couple of weeks, but, you know, it still wasn't very pleasant while it lasted, because she had just a breathtaking lack of self-awareness in that regard.
And we see that, you know, again, we go back to that notion of being a jerk without realizing it. We see that played out in leadership levels across all of our client organizations, from the CEO right on down, where, you know, they lead out of that self-protective, you know, I'm either going to be a really nice guy and that's how I'm going to approach leading, or I'm going to be really aggressive in my approach and autocratic in my approach to leading. And they don't realize that in the course of them choosing to lead, not effectively, but out of their own comfort zone or their own preference, that they are actually getting classed and called and referred to by their employees and their coworkers as jerks. And I think about a client that we have where, you know, his de facto is, if he doesn't like something his subordinates are saying, is, you don't know what you're talking about. That's stupid. You know, how stupid can you be? And that's, you know, his defense that he goes into, where they all talk about him being a jerk, but he doesn't realize that. He thinks he's being helpful in those conversations and letting them understand that they're wrong, And again, when you think about it, that's not effective in that relationship or in that dynamic. And it doesn't actually produce a better result. In the same way, you know, your example where she was speaking to you in the wrong language, they don't walk away from that understanding what they need to do or what they need to do differently, because he actually hasn't led them. He's just judged them and been a jerk in that situation.
Heather, what is it about managers and the Dunning-Kruger effect? I mean, good grief. It seems like every manager we've ever worked for is some kind of know-it-all. And most of the time, they're being incompetent. It's like a real-life Dilbert cartoon. And I mean, it happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's very, very pervasive. In fact, that's part of the reason why we wrote our book, So You Think You Can Lead, is because we saw this, the fact that leaders were either, you know, being that sort of douchey autocratic, or they were being excessively permissive and they just weren't leading at all. And yet these folks are getting ahead and getting promoted. And the truth behind it is that none of them have actually developed up any skills. It's like as though, you know, I'm promoted to be a leader, and so therefore I'm a great leader, and there's no work that has to be done to go from, you know, becoming one and actually being effective as one. And so what we see all the time is this incompetence, as you mentioned, in leaders at all levels of the organization. And that incompetence, as long as they're able to produce results, no matter what their behavior is, they get promoted and they get promoted, then they continue on without ever actually looking at their own behavior or understanding what they should be doing differently in order to be more effective.
Yeah, back in the business world, it happened all the time. We would see people get promoted up the corporate ladder just to get them the hell out of my work group.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with this person anymore. I can't fire them, because then I have to fill out a bunch of paperwork and it may have some backlash associated with it. So good grief. Just send them somewhere else to be on somebody else's team and, you know, promote them to make them feel good and shut up. You know, it was so crazy. So lazy crazy. You know,
we tend to call jerk-like behavior is usually people trying to do the very best that they can without any leadership development or even managerial skills. And the average age of a leader or a manager when they get training is 43. And on average, people are in leadership roles for about 9 years before they get any training. And that includes supervisor, manager. They can be going all the way up through the ranks in the organization and not have a lick of training. And so there's no reason to think that these people are going to have any self-awareness. They think that they're self-aware. I mean, all you have to do is ask them and they'll tell you that they have great emotional intelligence and they're very self-aware. But when you start talking to them about their frame of reference, they have little awareness of themselves and how they feel, and even less of an awareness of the impact of their behavior on their employees. They think they're great, and so they expect their employees to treat them as though they're great.
So to kind of land the plane here, these elements of jerkiness include, but not necessarily are limited to, this Dunning-Kruger effect of thinking I'm amazing when really I'm terrible and imposing that on everybody else. This gaslighting effect of making everybody else feel like they're jerks when really I'm the one being a jerk. An extreme selfishness, maybe even a desire to hurt other people or to mess with their emotions, deriving some sort of joy out of other people's pain. Those are the kind of things that make someone just a first-class jerk, right?
I think the other one that I would add to that is going into this place of passivity and acting like you're completely powerless. Because I think that's the other way in which we see this sort of jerk-like behavior on the other side. I mean, we talked about some of the more aggressive aspects of it, but there's also this really passive place that this can translate it into. We talk about Mr. Nice Guy or excessive permissiveness, you know, tolerating all kinds of bad behavior of others, you know, again, in the employment context, in the personal context, you know, not standing up for oneself and allowing people to talk to you however they want to talk to you, not defining things, you know, again, the expectations being clear around things. And so there is also this passive powerless, and they complain and they go in more into that victim place and talk about things as though it's, well, I can't do anything about it. And it's all hopeless. And, you know, these people are never going to change. And so I think we have to be clear too, that because it's easy to associate the more aggressive aspects to a jerk, but we forget that some of these other ways, we're also still being essentially a jerk in that relationship, because we're not focusing on how do we ensure that this moves forward? How do we ensure that we're being effective in our dynamic there?
Now, that's a fascinating angle for several reasons. First of all, the pendulum can swing the other way.
Yes.
Not only can I be an aggressive jerk, but I can be a passive jerk. Now, I have to admit, full disclosure, I was expecting you to talk exclusively there about passive aggression. Yeah, I'm being passive aggressive, which is I'm making you feel bad by pretending I'm not really trying to make you feel bad. Oh, poor me, etc., and making the other person feel terrible due to this dynamic that I can best describe as controlling by weakness. But you said something that's going to be shocking to a lot of the guys in this audience. Hey, you know what? You're a jerk if you're just simply passive, aggressive or not. You know, if you're playing the victim card, people are going to think of you as a jerk. And you mentioned the Mr. Nice Guy thing. And that is a huge stumbling block for a lot of men. We feel like we need to kind of soften up, be a little more timid, or else people will be scared or people will be offended. And it also kind of manifests in a way where men are kind of thinking, I want this woman in my bed, or I want some kind of relationship with her. But if I disclosed it, she would reject me. So I have to soft pedal this thing because I fear losing it. And what I think a lot of us don't realize is that causes people to find us even more distasteful. It pushes them away from us. It's more offensive to people. And here's the cherry on top of this sundae. Ready? It causes people to lose respect for us.
Yeah.
They think poorly of us in general. And this is really, really confusing to a lot of men because they're like, well, you know, I'm sort of quiet and I'm sort of shy and I don't mean any harm to people. And it just seems like people are angrier and treat me worse than they do people who are a lot more assertive. And I don't understand it. An example would be you go and order your lunch and the guy behind the counter goes, what do you want? And the person goes, well, I don't know. Oh, come on, man. Tell me what you want. And the person doesn't understand why this person's losing their cool with them. I mean, I was nice. I wasn't a jerk back. But if you respond in kind with this assertion, then you get what you want. Everybody's got what they need. And lo and behold, most people aren't really that easily offended anyway. But it seems like a lot of guys really don't understand that. And I've taken guys out in field and I've shown them how this works and said, hey, you know what? If you have a person has to say what back to you, then unfortunately you're going to get the same dynamic in your life that a lot of people who are actually deaf report, which is people are very angry and aggressive with them because they sort of hold them responsible for not being able to hear. And that's one of the things about being deaf that a lot of hearing people don't realize is, man, you just get, in a way, socially abused for something you really can't control. So this passivity really does cause people to like you less than they would even if you were, you know, a normie, right? Like middle of the road.
You know, we talk about the self-protective system of having these two spectrums of being autocratic or being permissive. And it's that difference between the dominating and the submissive behaviors. And it's a really good point that you're making, Scott, because what we really try and engender in our clients is that idea that we're trying to be authentic as leaders. We're trying to show up as people who are leading and not trying to please anybody and not trying to be a good leader and not trying to be like somebody else, but exercising their own leadership authority and in relationship as well, just exercising their own entitlements in a relationship that you have the right to show up and be quiet and be more of a listener. You have as a leader, you're entitled to be very firm, but fair. You don't have to try and be all things to all people, but you do have to check in with yourself and really start getting, who am I? You know, who's the person here who's leading? Who is the person who is in this relationship? And what are my needs? Because we work with a lot of leaders who have no idea how to ask for what they want, to give expectations of their employees. They're too frightened.
And it just irks people. It doesn't help.
It doesn't help at all.
No, and you know, if you think about it from that perspective of the vacuum it creates, so if you're trying to have a relationship with someone who's doing that, if you're trying to work for a leader who's behaving like that, it's this vacuum, and that vacuum then feeds, you know, sort of even more, you know, it could be insecurity, it could feed frustration, it could, you know, again, leading to the person referring to you as a jerk because you're not actually in it with the other person. And the other thing I want to say about when we see this passivity is we talk about them making emotionally driven decisions. And so the decision is an objective to say, what's the right approach or what's the best approach for this situation or how do we resolve this issue? It's how do I keep people from getting upset? So what do I need to say or what do I need to do or not say so that no one gets upset? And so the agenda and the energy of the individual is going to the wrong place because they're not actually trying to Anne's point, be authentic and sort of talk about it from this is what I need and this is what I would like to see and how do I negotiate for it? It's again going into that place of I just want to keep the peace and not rock the boat. And so I'm going to do whatever or not do anything in order to be able to preserve that notion of peace. And it just causes frustration in the people around them.
I think it's a revelation to many that conflict avoidance is jerkiness. I mean, that blindsides most people who have been living that life for a while when they figure that out. Meanwhile, on the flip side, being assertive actually helps build respect. People actually appreciate you more when you're very upfront about what you want and you need or what you're actually going to do for someone, the kind of person who will assertively promise something and then deliver it without over-promising. I think Mr. Nice Guy can sometimes over-promise and not be able to deliver, again, because they fear that loss. It's all fear-based. And that's just sort of an aside. But it's amazing to me how when people start exercising their human right to be assertive, and realize it is a social skill. And assertiveness to me is always valid as long as you have a point. I mean, if you're being completely unreasonable about what you're asserting, well, then I think you're still being a jerk. You're out in jerky land. But I mean, it's okay to say, hey, you know what? You promised me this and I didn't get it. Could you kindly please deliver what you promised? Now, if you're a husband and you refuse to do this, and vendors and waiters and waitresses and creditors and neighbors are walking all over you, it's not going to be too long before your wife, gentlemen, feels very unsafe with you being the man of the house. She's going to be like, can't you stand up to these people? And she's going to wonder if you have the ability to stand up for anything. And she's going to feel like she has to take it all on herself to get anything done around here. She loses respect for you as a husband. And then she starts nagging and then you're in divorce court.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know I rolled up about a year or two or a dozen years worth of misery in that one brief vignette, but that's pretty much the continuum of jerkiness in that context, isn't it?
It is. And I can relate to that story from the perspective of, you know, we hear it so much from our clients is like they look at this notion of assertiveness as an either or, right? Either I'm nice or I'm a jerk, right? And there isn't this notion of what does assertiveness and acceptable assertiveness or effective assertiveness look like? And one of the things that we often find is that people who are low assertive or so focused on being nice and more passive is they don't have a sense of their own authority. Anne talked about the notion of not feeling any sense of entitlement around, you know, how they get treated by others, what they're allowed to weigh in on, you know, where they get to say yes and no. And I think too that we get caught up in these relationships and we see it with our clients where the individuals that, you know, often get referred to as jerks is they're so focused on winning or they're so focused on being right in the situation that, again, it's not about that relationship and it's not even about asserting something or trying to get to the resolution of an issue. It's about winning in that context.
Oh, that quest to be right.
Mm-hmm.
One-upmanship. Oh, yeah. Man, that is so tiresome. Such a lack of social.
Well, stuff. It's also unconscious power dynamics where people are affirming themselves and their value or their usefulness by comparing and competing and moving into the area of narcissistic behavior where they overtly gaslight or devalue or in some other way make other people feel bad so that they feel better about themselves. And it's the same on the other end of the spectrum where those with a permissive defensiveness, those strategies where they give all of their power away to their employees and then wonder why their employees don't do what they want them to do. And so you see these unconscious power dynamics going on all the time in the absence of awareness that leaders have where they don't know what they're doing. They will say over and over again, well, I'm just trying to get the job done the best I can. And it's easier for me to do it myself than have to work with my employees around it.
You know, that's a fantastic point. And going back to what you just said, Heather, a couple minutes ago, it's equally fascinating to me that you're unbundling kindness from this dynamic. It has nothing to do with it. You can be assertive and be kind about it. You can value people's feelings and respect other humans even as you're being assertive. And I think that's something that when people think in a very binary way about being nice or being a jerk, they miss out on. There's a way to finesse all of this in a way so that you're gaining the respect and making the people on your team with you feel good about your leadership or good about you being a dad or a husband. You don't have to be a jerk about it instead of being Mr. Nice Guy. And, you know, this is something that comes up in dating and relationships all the time. There are these bits of bad dating advice that have somehow stuck and been carried along when they didn't deserve to be. And we talked about it rather recently on the show, frankly, whereby men are presented with this false choice of either being Mr. Nice Guy or a bad boy slash jerk. You can be a good, decent man of character who has enough confidence to be assertive, and that's a completely off-the-board choice from being either Mr. Nice Guy or being a jerk. So I appreciate the fact that both of you brought that up because it really underscores a lot of what's talked about here often. Now, in the interest of time, we have a couple other questions that I really, really want to get to because they're a lot of fun. Here's the first one, and this was your idea to put on the list of questions here, Anne. Are jerks born or made? I mean, am I just born a jerk and that's the way I am, or did I get jerky over time?
I think conditioning has a lot to do with what goes into our image of ourselves and our persona. And often when we're working out of an inflated idea of who we are, with the expectation that everybody should have that same idea of who we are, it really engenders jerk-like behavior in them when people don't behave the way they think they should. And these are the people who, you know, loud talkers in restaurants who believe that everybody wants to listen to them, or somebody at a board meeting who will hijack the meeting simply because they like to talk and they feel entitled to be seen. And because they've had it all their lives, the expectation is that people should continue to behave this way. And conversely, for those people who are now being brought up with helicopter parents, they believe that the world should unfold before them in the same manner that the parents created for them, in terms of if you have a barrier, then it's not your fault. If somebody is mean to you, then it's their bad and you're good and you should be protected because you're always good. And as a result of this, just to restate the point, our conditioning brings us into adulthood in our belief about ourselves and who we think we are. And then our experience either allows us to develop from that place, or we stay limited and only go into situations where we're going to be seen and treated the way we believe we should. You know, just in terms of how men and women are raised, there's still that bias toward upbringing where boys are expected certain things, girls are expected to do certain things, and we can grow out of them. The beauty of this is that we all have the opportunity to develop if we don't get stuck in our defenses.
You know, as you were talking, I couldn't help but be reminded of the simple fact that people who are victims tend to flock together. They find their little echo chamber of co-victimhood and kind of wallow in it together. So getting back to the idea of self-awareness, it's almost like when people who act like victims find other people who are like them, they somehow validate each other in their jerkiness, kind of oblivious to the rest of the world looking at them, rolling their eyes and going, God, I just want to get rid of these people. You know, you can spend a minute and a half on political Twitter and come to the conclusion everybody in the entire world is a jerk. Right. For this reason. But really, it's just a small microcosm of people who somehow enjoy trolling each other because, well, they're psychotic on Twitter. Heather.
Yes.
Can a jerk be reformed? And the reason why I'm asking this question is because I have this mental image that I think everybody can relate to of the guy, the big burly dude, you know, who works behind the counter at, say, an auto parts store. And he knows that being decent to his customers is really what's going to cause him to keep his job instead of getting fired for being just a total butt wipe to people. But you can tell he's fighting it with every ounce of his being. He wants to just lash out and be a jerk and call people names and be rude and laugh and be condescending and such, but he's fighting it. Like, he'll close his eyes, take a deep breath when he responds to anything you say. Like, if you ask for a certain kind of windshield wipers. And he says, I don't have those. He goes, all right, I don't have those, but we do have these, Mr. McKay, and they may work better. And he fakes a smile. I mean, it's just so funny to encounter people who are trying their darndest to fight their, I guess, primal urge to be a jerk. Have you ever seen this before? And how can we ease the pain back to being human to each other through that process, if we can relate to that story a little bit?
It goes back to the whole thing we started off with, this notion of nature versus nurture, right? And Anne said, you know, it jerks. Definitely, we look at nurturing from that perspective. And we all, as human beings, we have the ability to adapt our behavior. We have the ability to develop and create new neural pathways that allow us to break some habits that perhaps aren't so helpful for us. And if we think about being a jerk as a developmental gap, then yes, we do. The challenge is that, is there the underlying motivation and interest in making that change or doing that development? Because again, if we've grown up always being a jerk and that's gotten us what we want, and all of a sudden we're being told, hey, you got to stop being a jerk. And it's like, well, what's in it for me? Because this is my go-to. This is the only tool in my toolbox. And now you want me to use this other muscle of being nice and pleasant and, you know, friendly and helpful. And that muscle is really, really weak in my brain and my personality and my development. And so I don't want to use it because it's not fun for me. It doesn't feel comfortable. And so I think it does come back to that, you know, where is our motivation? What's our interest in this? And what do we really need? If you look at, in some cases, that continuous jerky behavior, despite feedback, despite knowing I should behave like this, but I still want to do this, is actually more indicative of the fact that perhaps you're in the wrong place. You're in the wrong role. You're in the wrong relationship. If you can't, you know, sort of move into something that allows your authentic self to be there and to be able to leverage your strengths like that, you know, sometimes we end up being jerks because we're just in a place where we don't get to use our strengths and our inherent talents. We don't get our needs met. And so we act it out in that context. So that can really get in the way of development. But it starts, as we've said a couple of times, I think here, that you have to start with that place of self-awareness, of really understanding kind of who you are, how you're wired, what is driving some of those, that self-protective behavior in you, so you can start to look at ways in order to develop or make changes in order to be able to move out of that self-protective state that's leading to that jerky behavior.
I'll tell you what, Heather, you've provided a wonderful segue to my last question by way of talking about how people sometimes don't want to change. They kind of like being a jerk. It's working for them. And indeed, if we were playing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, this would be the million-dollar question. Ready? This is the one I'm just waiting for an answer to with bated breath, because it's driven me nuts my entire life.
I just want to respond to that, Scott, because it's such an interesting thing that we can come from the assumption that everyone has the same degree of consciousness and the same runway for development. But we can get stuck anywhere in, and you can see it, adults acting like children or people getting stuck in adolescence saying, you know, I'll do whatever I want. Nobody's the boss of me. You can't tell me what to do. But that assumption that we all have capacity to develop gets in the way of so many relationships. And you alluded to it, where women or men will idealize the person that they're with, despite all evidence to the contrary, despite everything that the person is saying about who they are and what they want, that this idealization, the inability to be in reality and be conscious of how the other person is behaving toward them, without that light of consciousness, people will stay the same. They'll just stay protecting themselves because there's nobody else there. They have no access to their authentic self.
But I love him.
Then accept
him. He's just having
him.
A bad day. You know, that's the classic relationship between someone who's overtly optimistic and generous to a fault and the person who's taken full advantage of them because they're a narcissist. And, you know, to your point, Anne, before I ask the big question, because these guys are going to kill me if we get sidetracked from that. But before we go there, I'm starting to really buy into this notion that there are non-player characters out there. I mean, there are people out there who are genuinely not nice people, and they don't care to be nice people. They just are totally psychopathic, have no empathy for anybody else. They're solipsistic. They're in their own little world and just want to take everybody else down for their personal gain. And the most frustrating part about those people is they seem to understand people with a soul perfectly well. But the people who are trying to be good, decent people of character out there, can't bring themselves to the assumption that there are people out there who are like that. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they get, you know, these people, these NPCs, they run roughshod over normal, decent people and think it's hilarious. But that's a whole different show. Here's the question, okay? And either or both of you can answer this. Why did douchebags get ahead? Why do these people who are so jerky, so selfish, such shameless self-promoters, so arrogant, why do they gain a following? Why are they so influential so often? How come they're the ones who gain celebrity and have a million Twitter followers and people pay attention to and follow their leadership when they're just so openly jerky? What is the human dynamic there, ladies?
In psychology, it's closet narcissism, where people attach to narcissistic behavior because they want to bask in the glow of the fame and the success by being just sometimes in proximity. But it's the drive of the ego, not the drive of the authentic human being. But and to your point, Scott, around why do they get, are they so successful? They are singularly focused on meeting their own needs, and they have no regard for people over and above using them as objects to make them feel better about themselves. So when you have a single agenda like that, you think about it, you don't care what other people feel. If they feel something, if they tell you that you're hurting them, you can write it off. It doesn't matter. Your agenda matters. And these people are charming, manipulative. Of course, I'm talking about the narcissistic personality or defenses where it is just all about them. There is no room for anyone in that relationship. But it, on the outside, it looks fantastic because they make it sound like it's amazing every minute of the day. And people get pulled into the charm, into the that sort of swirl of the narcissistic charisma that makes them feel temporarily like they are someone special because of their proximity to that person.
I'm reminded of a radio commercial of all things I heard probably 10 years ago. I don't even remember what the product was for, but the gist of it was there was a narrator talking to someone who was an employee who was complaining about their boss and their douchey attitude and their shiny shoes. And then the conversation turned to, well, maybe you as an employee can build your skills so that someday you're smart. Yeah. Someday you're the boss. Yeah. And you're a douchebag with shiny shoes just like that guy. No, was the guy's answer. But boy, did that commercial hit on just about all the talking points you just brought up. You know what I mean? We kind of put up with the douchiness because deep down we'd love to be in that position ourselves. And because that person has ascended to this ivory tower, maybe they'll be willing someday to drag us up there with them instead of maybe keeping us down, you know, like the man. Every political leader in the social media era who's been elected to high office seems to fit that description. Doesn't matter what party they belong to, by the way. And yet so many people vote these people in without any regard for just how douchey, narcissistic, and jerky they really are. They just seem blind to it, or they don't want to see it, or they think this person's somehow going to help me if I get in their little cult. And it's just insane. And both sides are exactly the same, you know?
I think, Scott, on that, it's like one of the things that they do well is that they give people something to follow. They give people something to belong to. In a way, those leaders that are, you know, Mr. Nice Guy and are principled and valued and empathetic, they don't always come out with something that where they're really leading. They're not creating that vision, that sort of, you know, speaking to it in a way that gets people fired up, right? And so, whereas we see these jerks, like to Anne's point, their charisma, that ability, they don't care what people think. And so because of that, they can be really, really definitive. And for people that are feeling that need to have something to follow, something to anchor themselves to, you know, some place to belong, some identity, because they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily defining it or asserting it for themselves in their own lives. That's why they flock over there, right? And we see that in, you know, politics up here in Canada, as well as, you know, obviously what we see down in the US, but we see it in organizations
everywhere.
Too. Yeah. And even in relationships, quite frankly, if you know, you look at the relationships between, you know, sort of two individuals, and if one individual is really low assertive and conflict avoidant, they're going to attach to someone who is going to define things, who's going to lead them, right? And then you get into these, you know, some of the problems that emerge from that, because if that direction that they're leading them in, or the jerkiness starts to appear, you know, sort of later on along the way, you end up in conflicts, right? And dissatisfaction in that relationship. But if we don't learn how to lead ourselves and lead into, you know, our lives, our relationships, our work, we're going to look to attach ourselves to people that we think can represent that leadership in us that we're lacking on the inside.
Yeah. It's all about balance, I think. A good, healthy relationship seems to have a balance between those factors, between the two spouses. I think that's something else. And, you know, getting back to the politicians and their douchiness, man, a little NLP training goes so far with those folks. You can just dupe the entire population by reading one book. It's amazing. It's just amazing to me. Their names are Heather Hilliard and Anne Dronitsaris, and they are the leaders over at the appropriately named Caliber Leadership Systems in Toronto. They have several books, including Who Are You Meant to Be, which sounds kind of like a Jackie Chan movie to me, Power Past the Imposter Syndrome, which I hope you two will come back and talk about, because that's another huge issue. And the one that I'm going to point you to right now, the book called So You Think You Can Lead. And you only think so until Heather and Ann get through with you. Then you'll be a true champion. Go to mountaintoppodcast.com/caliber. And I know a lot of you guys are Second Amendment gun guys, so caliber is something you can easily spell, right? C-A-L-I-B-E-R. mountaintoppodcast.com/caliber. And you'll be able to pick up a copy of their book. Heather Hilliard and Ann Dronitsaris, thank you so much for what was a fascinating and deep conversation with a lot of content for these guys. Thanks a million.
Thanks for having
us.
Great fun.
Yeah, it was. It was surely fun. And I am serious in inviting you back. I do want to talk about imposter syndrome, because you two are very, very smart. And gentlemen, if you haven't, okay, we'll make it happen. And guys, if you haven't been to mountaintoppodcast.com in a while, be sure to check out our sponsors there, which include Jocko Willink's company, Origin in Maine. Great jeans, the best boots you will ever own, and fantastic protein powder for your workout regimen. Great stuff all around there. And also visit Hero Soap. They have body wash and clean soap made with no parabens or other nasty ingredients that'll mess with your body in a bad way. It'll only clean you up, make you smell good, and make women love you that much more. You can use the coupon code MOUNTAIN10 with either of our sponsors to get an extra 10% off when you purchase. And while you're at mountaintoppodcast.com, please be sure to get on my daily fluff-free newsletter and download a copy of my book for free, Sticking Point Solved. Now, gentlemen, everything you could possibly ever want to ask relative to dating and relating with women is probably covered in that book. Won't cost you a dime. Get in on board with that. And also, some of you guys still haven't talked to me for free for 25 minutes. I love getting to know you guys in the audience. We can talk about a coaching program for you. We're already well into 2022 here. The clock is ticking, and you need to get the right woman in your life. And hey, you know what? If coaching isn't right for you, it's still wonderful to talk to you guys so I know what's going on with you, so the show can be better, so that I can work more effectively for you. Go ahead and get on my calendar, grab the book, and there are also other goodies there, all at mountaintoppodcast.com. And until I talk to you again real soon, this is Scott McKay from X and Y Communications in San Antonio, Texas. Be good out there.
The Mountaintop Podcast is produced by X and Y Communications. All rights reserved worldwide. Be sure to visit www.mountaintoppodcast.com for show notes. And while you're there, sign up for the free X and Y Communications newsletter for men. This is Ed Roy Odom speaking for the Mountaintop Podcast.